video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are a go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Mic check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on here.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic. Today we're speaking to researcher, author, Joachim Van Wing from Brussels. Welcome.
Thank you, Len, for having me. Always good to hear you.
It's always my pleasure to speak to you, and we met at one of your conferences that you have annually, and we'll try to make a few links to the previous ones, but they're so good, and you have such interesting speakers. You really caught my interest, and today I'd like to talk about, since when we were together, we drove by the NATO headquarters there, and we didn't go in though, but you know, it's just interesting to see that when I hear news going on and I hear some news from people in Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and the story, and then I hear Lindsey Graham out here and all these other people saying, how we should be going to war, that I wanted to get today your opinion of what is going on in Europe. You live in Belgium, so you're close to what's going on. But some of these things, I just shake my head. I go, what are these guys doing? I mean, even I spoke to you yesterday, and we just mentioned about when Putin was interviewing Tucker Carlson, and he said to him, says, well, who blew up the pipeline? Right? You know, like, they just, people leave that alone. Like, they blew up a pipeline and crippled Germany and Europe's intake of energy. And nobody bats an eye, from my point of view. So I'm very interested in that you have had some very good economic advisors on your different seminars. And I would turn this over here. I know you have a few points that you thought we'll bring up today. So welcome to the show. And I was going to ask you, I guess, for a better headline, is just what's going on in Europe from your point of view?
Yeah, that question got me triggered when you asked me that question a few days ago. And it's particular. Problems are accumulating, especially political problems. But the underpinnings of this impossibility of govern, because that's the predicament Belgian and European governments are in, they have a great political difficulty in continue governing. And the same goes on. So you see what's happening in France. President Macron, who can no longer find a new prime minister, simply because whatever profile he pushes to the fore or puts in the saddle as his, I believe, sixth or seventh prime minister already, nothing will change. He can change his prime minister, but the problems and the predicaments France is in will not change by changing the prime minister. And these budgetary problems are totally new to France. France is a very socialist, left-wing society with a lot of social security, and people pay high taxes, and the government tries to provide great services, etc. But something in recent times has changed. And what has changed actually is the stance that the African countries are taking. They are looking to BRICS, to the East, and to all other members of the Global South to turn their economy and financial situation on. So to understand the real fiscal and financial problem that France is in, you have to know that there is still something which is called the CFA. It's the colonial French franc. So Paris still has a total grab on something like 14 African countries because it forces on these countries the use of the CFA. And there are two CFAs. These are two trade currencies. The one is the West African and the other one is the Central African. And to put it quite simply, it's actually a colonial era currency that's still used in several African countries. And that currency is guaranteed by France. These currencies are tied first to the French franc and since 92 to the euro. It creates some sort of stability for these African countries, but in return, they are obliged to keep large foreign exchange reserves account in Paris, controlled by Paris. And they are forced to deposit part of their reserves in the French treasury as well, and all in return for so-called stability. But these regimes, like especially Mali, Burkina Faso, Côte d'Ivoire, so Ivory Coast, these regimes are really distancing themselves from the colonial grip that France still had. So what's happening since these countries no longer participate as they used to do in this colonial currency, the CFA, it has a detrimental effect on the French finances because France loses access to those reserves and it loses currency transaction revenues as well. And it has no longer the financial leverage that it used to have on these countries to translate it into political power on the ground. And by consequence, because France can no longer force the CFA, this colonial franc, on its former colonies, these colonies are doing business elsewhere, which means the French companies who always had access to raw materials and trade lines and doing business with these countries and stripping their raw materials, these French companies now do less business and they bring less tax revenue to the French government. So what's happening in North Africa actually is one of the main reasons why France all of a sudden the last 12, 18 months has come into financial trouble. And that's all changed with the coup d'etat, the military coup that took place in Burkina Faso, in Mali, and some other smaller countries who were part of that French system. But not only France is in dire straits. I mean, Great Britain is on the verge of getting into a gilt crisis, a bond crisis, somewhat similar to what happened when Liz Truss spooked investors something like 2 or 3 years ago by imposing unfunded tax cuts. And it spooked everyone in the market and it only exaggerated the large fiscal deficits, upped inflation. And capital is flowing away from Great Britain and they are on the verge of a gilt crisis. And if you look at Italy, Italy has a 140% debt to GDP. It has slow or little or no growth. The expenditures are rising for the government and inflation is high. And most of all, borrowing costs for the Italian government are getting higher every day. In Belgium, we are a small economy. We have a GDP of a little over 500 billion a year, and we are urgently looking for 10 to 30 billion euros, which is not, it doesn't seem to be that much money since 2008, but still 10 to 30 billion euros is for a small economy like Belgium is quite a problem, a budgetary problem. And then perhaps the Netherlands, where the government is demissionary, their prime minister, Mr. Schoof, he's a former intelligence, the head of Dutch intelligence, a bit like George Bush or Vladimir Putin, who headed the intelligence services previously in an earlier career. So also in Holland, in the Netherlands, they find it pretty hard to keep forming governments. And if you look at the rest the whole of Europe, you'll see the same thing. All these current regimes, let's call them political regimes or the current governments, they are Everywhere, what they call right-wing politics is on the rise. These are conservatives, right-wing, against immigration, etc. But none of these, and I always find it astounding they call them right-wing, because the last thing they'll do is cut back government services or government expenditures. So they all these so-called right-wing parties in Europe, they call them right-wing, but they will only increase the power of the government and keep spending even more. So that's a quick overview of the political situation European countries are in actually currently.
There also seems to be this slant, you said right-wing tyrannical, where they want to shut down opposition. They're really trying to clamp down on social media, on people being able to communicate with themselves, you know, whatever, if it's X or Twitter or whatever, you know. It's just really appalling that they're fighting the very people that they're supposed to help organize.
There is something you need to know about Europe. I mean, we all have sovereign governments and parliaments, let's say. It's like a show, it's like a circus, because the real power, of course, is the European Union and the European Commission. And the Commission is not elected democratically. It's a council that's been formed by peers amongst them, traveling between Strasbourg and Brussels. So that's where the real power resides, and these national governments take care of local details. But something like chat control that they want to impose, which would give unimaginable powers to invade your privacy and everything you do online and all your communication, email, whatever is going on your smartphone. That's been adverted for now, but I see it coming. It's just a matter of time before they will impose this chat control.
Yeah, and they're wanting to go to digital ID, and they're trying to get rid of cash. And you hear these stories of people wanting to take out $10,000 from their own bank account, and they're saying, no, that's too much. You can't, you know, you can't. What's this for, right? So I want my own money. I want to take my own money out.
If you want to buy something, I believe the threshold now or the limit is something, I thought it was €3,000. That's about the maximum price you can pay cash for buying an item or a service. Everything beyond needs to be invoiced and needs to be paid digitally, needs to be wired from bank to bank. And I thought Mrs. Lagarde, the head of the ECB, the European Central Bank, even said she wanted to lower that limit to €500. And you see this going on all over the place. I mean, all over the spectrum. Everything will be controlled and monitored. It's this 360 full spectrum surveillance. The place where I live, and perhaps in North America, it's pretty hard to imagine the sort of landscape or the sort of villages we have. I am surrounded by cameras on the street, and they follow me. If I step into my car and I start driving, it'll take me probably 30 or 40 kilometers before I'm out of the eye of the camera. So on every corner is a camera, and you drive from camera to camera to camera to camera. And if your average speed goes over the speed limits, you'll automatically receive something in the mail for you to pay. It's all automatically. There's no policeman on the side of the road with a radar installation who tracks your speed. There are pylons and on every street corner, and automatically they scan every license plate, and whichever license plate drives from point A to point B at a too high average speed over the speed limit, yeah, you get a fine automatically.
Wow, that's Big Brother right there.
Yeah, but it's for our safety. It's for our safety. And it might be astounding for North Americans to hear this, but easily 20-30% of the population here is really glad these cameras are there. And the other 30-40% don't mind because they have nothing to hide. My guesstimation would be only 20% or 30% really take issue being surveilled by camera 24/7. And I'm one of these difficult characters who take issue.
Yeah, I see a lot of videos in I think London, where a group of gang, they call themselves the Blade Runners. They cut down these cameras almost nightly.
Yeah, but this is London. I mean, that's the inner city. We are here in Belgium. We're talking villages, rural villages. I mean, with cameras on every street corner, tracking every license plate.
Okay, so back to my overview of Europe, and I started off by saying I still can't believe that they have not made a bigger deal about the Nord Stream pipeline being blown up. I think you had mentioned earlier, or was speaking to you yesterday, about that Germany is really the economic heart of raw materials come from all over Europe into Germany. They're manufactured there, then sent back out. And do you have an opinion about this, about how if Germany is suffering so bad that the rest of the Europe can't help but follow?
Well, I have a very strong opinion. And so the first thing we discussed, the financial problems all these European governments are in, it's because they are all in a debt crisis. And a debt crisis is a very, very simple and easy to understand mechanism. It's when your debt grows faster than your economy. Now, the only thing an economy needs, and ask the Chinese, they've proven that for the past 20 years, and the US has been demonstrating this maxim for the past 100 years, the only thing you need is energy. Lots of it and cheap. And that's exactly what we're lacking. We are lacking energy, and the energy we infuse into our industry and economy is more expensive than ever. And on top of that, we are switching from plenty, reliable, cheap energy to complex, intermittent, expensive energy, which they call the green transition. But as, what's his name again? Jean-Baptiste Fresseau, this French engineer, explained, there is no such thing as a transition. So whatever wind and solar you add, it will never cut down the amount of fossil fuels, liquid fuels, crude oil, coal, gas. It will never reduce the amount of energy we will consume. Adding wind and solar will only expand the total amount of energy we infuse into our economy. So this the green transition is really a chimera. It's a hoax, because it's no transition. We simply add these new means of electricity production onto the existing install base. But if you look at the situation Germany is in, it's a disaster. It really is. You can go over the financial and the economic news, and every single day, one of these large, big blue chip companies, these German companies, they are cutting down 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 workers, and they are shrinking. Everything in Germany is shrinking, and European companies are no longer competitive. And it's due to expensive LNG that needs to be shipped in instead of cheap Russian gas that came in by pipeline. Yeah, I mean, we had in Europe, we had Frédéric Bastiat. He was a French economist, one of the early ones, who said his maxim is really simple. All you need to do is trade with people, trade with your neighbors. Going to war will always destroy capital, and it'll lead to bad investments, to non-performing investments. And these are the sort of debts, if you are creating credit and you're expanding the money supply, or let's say the credit supply, because on the other side of credit always is debt. If you are creating credit and infusing it in and expanding the money supply with bad credit, it'll come back to haunt you. It'll push you in a deflationary cycle. And this is what we're seeing right now. We are divesting ourselves, and we are investing in low-yielding, bad economic activities like building weaponry, artillery shells, etc. Because armaments, they eat a lot of money and wealth and value and wealth, and they are made to destroy other capital investments. Capital investments of your adversaries, capital investments you want them to have for you to do business with them. Because if you are destroying your neighbor's economy, you're losing a customer or a supplier. And that's exactly what's happening right now in Europe. And we all know all these people who got killed over the past 30 years, like the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. He was killed by very right-wing Swedish, well, let's call them militias, simply for speaking to the Russians or wanting NATO to speak with Russia. Back in, if my memory serves me, 86. And then someone who's really little known, Alfred Herrhausen, he was the German CEO, let's say, or the main man behind the Deutsche Bank. He was killed in 89. And because his opinion was, well, since the curtain has come down and the USSR no longer exists, there is no longer this threat, so we can start, we can cut armaments and defense spending and use it for other means. And perhaps, why not, we can lower or cancel the historic debt of African and Asian and South American countries. We can up to 50% of their long running debt. We can cancel that. And what he also said was, now that the Iron Curtain no longer exists and the USSR is no longer there, perhaps we should start do business like never before with a country like Russia. And it's not a surprise that he was killed in 89. And he was really one of the big guns of the German economy, also the political system, because he was the main man of the largest bank of Germany. His murder is little known, actually, which is astounding. The guy was called Alfred Herrhausen.
Oh, I know the name well. Fletcher Prouty wrote about him and wrote about that. And I think even later his secretary was killed, personal secretary. I mean, it's just, yeah, they blew him up in the street, I believe.
Exactly, on his way to the office.
Yeah.
With an explosion system that could not be used by the Rote Armee Fraktion, the Red Army fractions, this communist guerrilla that killed politicians left, right, and center in the 80s. But that time, when they killed Herrhausen, an explosive was used that could not have come into the hands of communist guerrillas or whatever.
Yeah, I know exactly what you
mean. Very strange.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I just heard six or seven politicians have been killed mysteriously, heart attacks, whatever, just recently, because they were a right-wing party and they would have probably have taken over completely. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Len, Hammarskjöld was killed in those days for wanting peace. So was JFK, Palme, Herrhausen. And I can assure you, Friedrich Merz, the current German chancellor, he will not be killed. He doesn't have to fear, because he's not for peace.
Well, you talked about munitions and arming and that. What's the feeling there in Europe over Ukraine? Because, you know, I heard one of the economists talk and they said there was three countries that had a negative number of gross national product and things you measure your economy by. And Ukraine was one of the three, and the other two countries were pretty poor. It seems like the America, if you read the book Provoked, tricked this attack on Russia and then forces all of European Union to almost bankrupt themselves to get into this put up civil war, which is going to end in bankrupting so many countries in Europe.
Actually, it's a total disaster. And if you would read European social media comments on X or on Facebook, you'll be astounded how many people really advocate for this strong stance against Russia, which I find incomprehensible, because the only thing we need to do is do business, even with our hardest and most difficult neighbors. And it's an authoritarian, repressive regime in many ways. The Russian society and the Kremlin doesn't allow for political adversaries to come to the fore. That's all true. But nonetheless...
Well, neither does Ukraine. They outlawed elections.
Yeah. So that's really the definition of a proxy. And we don't need to go into that. I mean, everyone who does a little bit of research knows that Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt were the masterminds behind a coup d'etat in 2014, a democratic elected president and government were chased out of office and replaced by, I would say, the most despicable regime that Europe has seen in the past 90 years. And the first thing Viktor Poroshenko back in 2015 did was launching a civil war onto the Donbas, the people in the Donbas, who are 80-90% of them are Russian speakers and are more aligned with Russia, and taking Crimea, of course. And it's and people in Europe, lots of them, family members of mine, friends of mine, they say, yeah, but Crimea belongs to Ukraine and it can never be Russia. I always ask them, imagine what would happen if, let's say, I don't know, the Japanese or the Chinese would try and take Pearl Harbor, where it's one of the most important, most strategical Navy bases of the US. Imagine trying to grab Hawaii or Pearl Harbor out of the hands of Washington. That will never happen. But somehow we expect Moscow to simply hand over their most important marine harbor and a military harbor to European Union, to the US, to whoever, to Ukraine. And people are astounded why they don't just hand it over. This double standard is incomprehensible to me. Incomprehensible. And the last thing, or not the last thing, but something I think is worthwhile mentioning, Russia will never allow an anti-Russian regime at its borders. Never. So if you go over all the neighboring countries, Bulgaria, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Mongolia, they will never allow an anti-Russian regime mustering forces at its border. It will never allow. The same goes for Washington. Imagine as if Washington would allow for Mexico or Canada to become an anti-American regime, putting missiles on their front lines and on the border, aimed at the largest American cities. That would never happen. Washington wouldn't allow a regime change in Canada or in Mexico, with an adversary installing weaponry right on the borders, cruise missiles, whatever. But somehow people expect Russia to bend over and to allow for all that.
Yeah, and in the background to that, before the coup, and everybody knows it's a coup, and all you've got to do is study it, listen to any 1 hour of Mike Benz, but, you know, or Horton.
If I can recommend Jacques Beau. His name is Jacques Beau, and Beau is written B-A-U-D. He's a Swiss former colonel. He worked for the UN and for NATO, and he knows all about it. And he's got first-hand information because he was a weapons inspector for small arms also in Ukraine after in the 2000s period, in the 90s and in the years 2000. Jacques Beau,
okay,
a Swiss Army colonel.
Yeah, I'll make a link to that. Send me an email after the show here. And, you know, this is something that goes over the heads of people who take a contrary point of view than I do. They just kind of gloss over it like as if it doesn't matter. You don't talk about the Nazi feeling of Western Ukraine, Banderas, the parades, the statues, the Azov Battalion. I mean, in Canada, they invited a fella that was fighting in Ukraine, and then the Ukrainian president was there. And then they said, okay, you know, he's fighting the Russians, right? And then some reporter just thought, well, wait a minute. A Ukrainian fighting the Russians? What was going on? And he found out he was a Nazi soldier killing other fellow Ukrainians. So Vladimir Putin said, we're going to denazify. We're fighting Nazis still. And I think when they surrounded that one plant, they forced all the prisoners to come out when they surrendered with their shirts off. So you could see these big swastika tattoos and things like that they had for the Azov Battalion. It just,
it's Azov Steel Factory.
Yeah, right. And the thing is, it's astounding to think that's what's going on. As soon as you look into it.
But then again, Len, European history and European heritage is somewhat complex and different and perhaps not totally appreciated by Americans or Canadians. But don't forget that the Ukrainians, they felt liberated when the Nazis drove into the country because they chased out the repressive communist regime of the Russians. And so they were, the Ukrainians perceived the invading German armies as liberators, because they were really suppressed, and there was a large synthetic famine organized by Stalin in the 30s. So the Ukrainians in particular suffered a lot under Lenin and Stalin in the 30s. And
Valid points. Yeah, those very valid points, right?
You won't hear me apologize or make a case for Nazification, etc. But that's a feeling that still lives. The way we in Belgium have memories of the Germans and the liberation by the Americans and etc. and the resistance. The same goes for the Ukrainians, but in a totally different light.
Well, there's a lot to it, and I urge people to study it for themselves. But as I mentioned, there's the book Provoked by Scott Horton, and Mike Benz will give you a good background about just how, I think, crooked. I mean, remember when Biden was saying the Burisma oil and getting his son there, who was like, I don't want to belittle Hunter Biden too much, but you know, just the fact that he had no knowledge about anything, and all of a sudden he's on the board of directors, getting thousands of dollars a month as somebody important. And then they found out they're looking into this corruption, and Biden lands and says, I'm telling him, fire the head investigator. Fire him or we're not giving you any, you know. And he says, what did he say? And by George, by the time I was ready to fly, they fired him or whatever.
And something else about Ukraine, Len. There is still this idea that Ukraine is all about raw materials and energy, and it's a great place to start fracking for shale. And it has large deposits of rare earths. And in a way, it's true. I mean, it's a rich country. They do have some deposits, but it's not about those raw materials. It's not about the rare earths in Ukraine. First of all, it'll take another 20 years before the country is stabilized enough and infrastructure is put in place for these volumes to come out to the world market. And second, these are very, very small quantities. But the real raw materials conflict that's going on is not about the raw materials in Ukraine. It's about the raw materials in Russia. That's the real goal. So in front of the curtain, we see Ukraine, but it's all about what's behind the curtain, and that's Russia. And I do get it. I mean, Langley and the Pentagon, and they have reason to be afraid and to be very, very concerned, because what we see happening right now is a total takeover of BRICS. But let me first say that if you think that what we saw happening in China over the past 20 years is astounding and is an economic miracle, which it is, then that will be just reduced to a footnote compared to everything that's about to happen right now and in the next 20 years. Just imagine what's about to take place. We have the largest deposits and the largest provider of raw materials combined with the largest industrial machine ever built, namely China, fed by the cheapest labor in the world, India. Imagine what will happen within the next 20 years when India, cheap labor, materials from Russia, and industrial know-how are combined into a new economic machine. It'll crush every other economy in the world, and it'll create even larger problems than it already does today, because if European car makers are closing and Ford Motor Company is cutting the lines and are stopping production for a few days, it's all because of low demand. And that's it's not untrue. That's part of the explanation. And it's not a lie. There is low demand for electric cars and cars, etc. But the real reason these companies are shutting down several days a week or are cutting down 10, 20, 40,000 people at once is because they no longer receive raw materials and parts from China. I've written a Substack on that. And since the 4th of April, China has stopped exporting every single critical raw material and rare earth to Europe and to the US. So every single car, not only EVs, also internal combustion engines, all these petrol cars as well, they need magnets for the windows to operate electronically, for switching on the air conditioning, for whatever. So stocks are depleted and China is no longer delivering these materials. And China has a stranglehold on every value chain in raw materials. They own the concessions and the mines in Africa. They own the railroad that brings the raw materials to the African harbor. They own the maritime lines and the cargo ships. They refine it in their own factories in the south of China, and they ship it out to the rest of the world with their own commercial fleet. So they own total value chain of all materials. If you go over cobalt, copper, magnesium, whatever, they control 90% of the world's production, from the mine onto the container deck in every single harbor where they unload their finished goods. And on top of that, they make all the profit and they earn the added value they create in their factories. So they will not sell us magnets. They will not sell us copper or magnesium or whatever. They will sell us the finished goods, which is where they make money. The finished good has all the added value, and it's going right back to China. And perhaps I can do a little prediction, and I don't care if I'm proven wrong within the next few years. Let's see. My feeling is something is about to happen in China. They are, and I'm going to make this as short as possible. Remember how Japan developed itself after World War II? It was something called window guidance. Japanese banks lended all the money to whatever industry or factory that would add capacity on capacity on overcapacity on overcapacity. And these Japanese companies, they ruined each other and itself by going into competition with other factories, making the same stuff even cheaper. But as a result, of course, the best companies remained, survived, and the bad ones went broke. At some point, the Japanese government stopped the expansion of the credit to an ever overheating industry, put a hold on overcapacity in its industry, and we're going to see the same thing happening to China right now. So, because the same has been happening in China over the past 20 years, the same which happened to Japan in the 50s and the 60s. So imagine what will happen in China when they no longer add bad credit on bad credit by investing into capacity that is no longer needed and will not yield any margin or added value. Imagine what will happen when suddenly fewer Chinese companies have less internal Chinese competition. These companies finally will start making money. That's what's going to happen, in my opinion. So you will see the Chinese industry shrink somewhat. The real explosive growth or the two-digit growth will probably never return. But in return for a lower growth, there will be less malinvestment and less overcapacity, which means existing Chinese companies will start making huge amounts of money. And that's something we will see happening in the next few years, I'm sure. And if I'm wrong about it, I'll be wrong about it. Let's see. Let's wait and see.
It is unbelievable if you look at the high-speed rail that has gone on from, say, the year 2000, the last 20, 25 years of how they have increased transportation throughout China. When you see a map or an animation of it, how they had one or two trains, and then the whole country now is it's unbelievable. I should try to find a link for that. You know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Wow. And I have a neat anecdote on that. I was in China, in Shanghai, in 98. I remember well. And just an anecdote. We were sightseeing and visiting the city, Shanghai, and we were walking through with our guide and our translator we were walking through an ancient neighborhood with wooden houses, people living on the street, dirty streets, small alleyways, filthy, old, dilapidated houses in a very old, almost medieval neighborhood. And our guide told us while we were walking through this ancient part of Shanghai, the old part of Shanghai, she told us, listen, this is going to be renovated. This part, well, this neighborhood will be emptied out. People will be forced to move, and we're gonna put large buildings here for business, etc. And so we were listening. So sure. Development. Yeah. China is building. China is going forth. Yeah. Right. We get it. And we walk out of this neighborhood and across the street, because it was so warm, we bought a soda pop, and we sat there drinking a cold beverage, looking straight into this old neighborhood. Lo and behold, 5 days later, we were coming back from the opera in a cab with the same guide in the cab. And on our way to the hotel, the guide shouted to the driver, stop the car. So the car stopped, and we looked at the left-hand side of, and we saw a huge building pit, like hundreds and hundreds square meters of excavated, 10 meters deep, the concrete already being poured in, and the foundations for big housing, etc. And the guide asked, do you see where we are? And we said, no, we don't. And then we looked to the left-hand side, and we saw the little shop where we bought the beverage 4 days earlier. So these 40, 50,000 people living in these wooden houses were living there 4 days earlier. And 4 days later, all these people were moved out, and it was excavated, and building was already taking place. So when the Chinese tell us, listen, we're going to renovate this, and we're gonna build something, they're not talking about years. They're talking about in the next few days.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I think when COVID hit, they didn't have a hospital. They built a hospital like in 2 or 3 days or something. It was unbelievable. They just said they started pouring concrete and stuff, and then they had a hospital built there. Even conservatives say a week or 2 weeks later, there was a hospital. Okay, well, we were touching on Ukraine and how this put-up war is draining Europe, but you say people are in favor of that. They are still in favor of, we've got to arm against Russia. They think Russia's coming for everything. And yet, Ukraine seemed to be a failed state. And like you mentioned, Victoria Nuland, those phone calls that were leaked to how they were just planning the whole thing. Oliver Stone did a film with Igor Lopatonik, Ukraine on Fire, and then revealing Ukraine. It's just astounding that people have fallen for this and decided to take all.
Well,
they're draining the European Union to fund this war. Yep. On behalf of what? On behalf of America, who wants to cripple the European Union.
Len, it reminds me of the interview you did with Fletcher Prouty way back when he told this anecdote where he was head of operations and head of logistics, and they were shipping and preparing to invade the Japanese islands. And when the two atomic bombs were dropped, the invasion was called off because Imperial Japan surrendered, right? And so Fletcher was telling in one of these interviews you did with him that he was already organizing the shipment of all these armaments and material, etc., back to the American West Coast. And one of his superiors told him, oh, Fletcher, you take half of all the material and you ship it to Korea, and the other half you ship to Vietnam. So what did he actually tell? That big wars are prepared decades in advance, like the Korean War and the Vietnamese War. And the same goes for the war with Russia and the war with Ukraine. And there's something you should know about Europe as well. I mean, we shut down all our nuclear facilities, let's say 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, our politicians and governments started vilifying petrol cars and diesel, especially diesel. Diesel was bad. Diesel needed to be banned. No longer diesel cars. Everyone should run on petrol or preferably electric. Now, Who is our largest supplier of enriched uranium as a fuel for our nuclear plants? It's Russia. Who's our main supplier for 70% of the diesel we consumed in our economy? It was Russia. So when they started vilifying diesel 10 years ago and they started to shut down our nuclear plants, once again, it's as if they had a crystal ball. They needed to decouple in advance from the supplier who would sooner or later turn into an adversary.
Yeah, I remember talking to one person through email that was in Ukraine, and I said, unfortunately, I see this going on as what happened to Yugoslavia, that I think that BlackRock, they are going to cause this drain of the Ukrainian economy where they will have such a debt that they will come in and say, okay, the government is going to fall, it's dissolved, and there'll just be these small provinces, and no one province will have any power to do anything against somebody like a BlackRock. And then they will just take out all the resources, saying, you know, in an austerity kind of thing, that, you know, well, you owe us so many billions, so we're taking out your coal or your wheat or whatever. Whatever they thought they had promised from the Donbass region, with the Donbass people wanted autonomy, and they said, no, we're just keeping ourselves together. You know, whatever you guys are doing in the Western Ukraine, we're not part of it.
No, and nothing is more lucrative than war. I mean, if the biggest money in the world, the largest funds, the largest industries, armaments, etc., for them, it's war is a big bonanza. And especially for the banks, because they always provide credit to both sides, and they gladly lend money for rebuilding a destroyed country. They gladly lend money for buying the arms, and they gladly help a regime that needs to pay a war reparation. And yeah, they gladly take the fruits of the victorious economy that will prosper by defeating an adversary.
Yeah, and that crazy Lindsey Graham saying that no Americans are going to fight in this war. What's your opinion and the on the street level there of all the Ukrainian generations being wiped out, just hundreds of thousands of the, I hear, I hate to say how old they are, but it's like 50-year-old conscripts are grabbing people off the street into a van. I've seen many videos. They just grab them and throw them to the front line.
I am wondering if it's about time to evacuate my two sons. I mean, what will happen when the Ukrainian cannon fodder has all been wasted? The European Union, NATO wants at all costs to continue this conflict. Will they start muster infantry from European countries? I don't know.
That is a serious thought you have?
Yeah, that's no, I'm not kidding.
In Belgium.
Yeah, I'm serious. I'm a dad. I have two sons, and I'm really worried that they might be forced to enlist in the next couple of years because they are perfect military age. And that's something that,
And then one thing, I saw a really cheeky documentary, I think it was something to do with the Riviera Battalion, where the rich people had got their people out of Ukraine just ahead of the war starting, so that down there there's a lot of Ukrainians in there partying on boats and all that. They're not fighting that battle. America, CIA has started this war, and unfortunately they did not cripple Russia at all, and the opposite has affected. And you mentioned BRICS. Do you want to just give a brief overview for people who are not familiar with that?
I can't imagine people are not familiar with that. Because
it could be.
It could be, indeed. So BRICS, of course, stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And these five founding countries have now been joined by, just to name a few, Iran, Egypt, Ethiopia, etc., lots of other countries. BRICS now is a larger exporter of crude oil than OPEC. That's something people tend to forget. Even bigger than BRICS, let's say, is the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a huge organization of sovereign countries. Let's call it the SCO is the third world equivalent of NATO. It's an economic, but it's also a military alignment of all these countries. And if just Google SCO, go for pictures and find the world map and see how big the landmass is of all the countries that are SEO members, and then try and figure out the population these countries represent. It's easily 70%, 60% of the world population is member of SEO. And
if I could interrupt, what happened was they tried to put all these sanctions on Russia. They tried to take them off the international credit system, which was, I think, called SWIFT. And they thought this was going to end it. And now these core countries, as you said, enough of America. We're doing our own thing. And you mentioned the five or six original, and now there's many other countries starting on. So that's,
imagine, Len, what's happening with these sanctions. So if you can impose sanctions on a nuclear superpower like Russia, then imagine what a Nigerian or a Chilean or a Vietnamese government must think. If you can do that to Russia that has nuclear weapons, then we don't stand a chance. And so they know the die is cast, and they are preparing and decoupling from the dollar. And so the dollar is losing huge amount of trade volume, and the petrodollar cycle has come to an end. And if you look at the fiscal problems and the debt problem that America is in right now, then don't look too far. They have alienated all these countries that were forced to use the dollar as the only means of transaction for international trade. And all these countries are decoupling, and all these countries now within the BRICS are doing business in their own currencies, or in the yuan, which is gold-backed, and will be even more backed in the future. So the yuan is as good as gold, and every single country selling its raw materials to China does accept yuan. And the fewer foreign exchange reserves in dollar-denominated reserves they need to put on their books, the better for them. And the less exposure and the less dangerous it is for these countries, because they know this, they've seen what can happen if you're too close to the US, when you're buying too many dollars to simply to do trade, and what risks it holds. Who was it who said it? I thought Kissinger said it. It's to be an enemy of the US is dangerous, but to be a friend is lethal.
Yeah, it might have been Kissinger. Fatal.
I think so.
Yeah, fatal. Yeah, it's crazy.
Some silly anecdote. Going over sanctions against Russia. Why are European airline companies, they made big money on the long hauls, the long trips from Berlin to Shanghai, direct flights from Brussels to Hong Kong, from London to, I don't know, to New Delhi, etc. But all these flights went over Russia. And now all these European airline companies need to make a big detour via a southern route, adding 2 hours and 2 hours of fuel costs, adding hundreds of dollars for a one-way ticket. Now, who is flying over Russia at a lower cost and 2 hours faster than the Europeans? It's the Chinese companies. So the Chinese companies have taken, the airline companies have taken over all these routes. So once again, these measures imposed on Russia is simply killing the cash cow for the European airliners.
You just see the absolutely insane Lindsey Graham raving about how this is a good idea. I have I have a joke for you, okay? It's getting so bad that I can't even order Russian dressing.
Oi, I don't get it.
Okay, this is salad dressing we have. It's called Russian dressing, right? That's just a joke. So maybe I should cut that out.
Well, so I'm in the plastics industry, and a few years ago, I spoke with a Dutch business partner of mine who did a lot of trade with Russia and who traveled to Russia very often to do business in that region. And he told me as a sort of joke, he said, "No, doing business with Russia is not that pleasant. And doing business with Russia is actually very, very dangerous because you need to travel through Ukraine twice." Just illustrating what a dangerous country back then Ukraine was, how corrupt, etc.
Yeah.
So he was always fearful having to drive from Poland all the way through Ukraine before he was in the safety of Russia.
Yeah.
So that traveling through Ukraine for him was the most dangerous part of his business trip to Russia.
And I thought it was a breath of fresh air when Tucker Carlson went to interview Vladimir Putin. And you got to see what a smart, intelligent man he was. If you agree with him or disagree, whatever, we, you know, everybody's got their problems. But then Tucker went out to the streets of Moscow and stuff and went to shopping centers and went to buy food. And he said, in spite of all these sanctions, they're thriving on their own. And when these other, like McDonald's and other things pulled out in protest, just other companies came in and moved and set up. And I forget, whatever the McDonald's were, it sat empty. So it was called Uncle Something, you know. It was like they just put up another burger place there, you know, and it was a Russian one. And that was that. And they said kind of good riddance to America.
Well, the Russian economy and the industry has totally immunized itself from these sanctions. It has become stronger than ever before. Right now, they are producing all internally, all themselves. They are importing less stuff from Europe and the US, and they are producing it themselves. They are developing new technology in the industry, and what they don't develop themselves, they'll buy from China. And there is a great professor. His name is Richard Connolly. You should really look him up. He has done a few interviews. Richard Connolly, he's the official advisor for NATO and the European Union. And the only thing he says is, Russia is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. The ruble is stronger than ever before. The national debt is only 20%. And even with an increase of armaments expenditures from 5% of GDP to 8%, I believe it is currently, even with that many investments into warfare and armaments, over the past year, Russian national debt has dropped from, I believe, 22 to 20%. And it is true they have a lot of inflation. It's over 10%, but then again, the interest rate is 20%. If you compare that to European countries and America, for instance, our inflation is way higher than our interest rates, which means we are destroying the value of our currency. And Russia is doing the opposite. It's safeguarding, it's protecting the value of the ruble. And it's cutting down on economic growth by higher interest rates. Because otherwise, the economy would even overheat more than it already does. So whoever is believing whatever Bloomberg and the BBC or whoever is putting out as if the Russian economy is about to topple and is bankrupting itself and the war effort is depleted. No, the opposite is taking place. And don't take my word for it. Take the official advisor to NATO and the EU, Dr. Richard Connolly. Look him up, listen to him, and listen to what he says.
Yeah, you know, the same thing's happening to the Canadian dollar. I could have bought an ounce of gold just a few years ago for $2,000. And I think yesterday it's up over 4,000 US.
But of course, gold is not getting more expensive. The value of gold isn't rising. It's rising gold prices. It's not gold getting more expensive. It's the purchasing power of the currency dropping.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
That's all it is. That's all it is. And that'll go on for quite some time. I mean, people, please don't take this as investment advice, because it's not. But when people ask me, do you think, Joachim, do you think that gold will keep on rising even more than it is today? It's an all-time high. Shouldn't I start selling my gold? Then the only thing, I have two questions. If you think gold will no longer go up, it means you think that the fiat currencies would stop draining and losing their value. They are losing their value hands over fist, and it'll keep on going on. So the more the dollar, the pound sterling, the euro, the yen increase the money and are flooding and destroying the purchasing power of its own currency, and the higher the gold price will turn out. And then secondly, imagine you sell your gold. Okay, what are you gonna buy? What are you gonna buy instead or invest in instead? Name me one asset category that will perform better over the next 12 months than gold and silver. I find it hard to find an asset class that with some certainty, guarantee, and security will deliver as much as gold and silver, as currencies are losing their values.
Well, we've covered quite a bit today. I think it might almost be reaching a saturation point for listeners right now that we've covered. And I think maybe I should have you on again for another hour, because I know you wanted to talk about COVID and some of the doctors that you've had interviewed on your, but that might take another hour or two. So why don't we just wrap up with the monetary situation and your views of Europe, which very good. You've made mention of some other people. I'll put links. You can email me and we'll, the other researchers and economists that you mentioned, we'll make sure other people, if they're interested further, can listen to them. I've listened to a few of them that, like I said to you earlier, that I didn't know about, but thanks to you, it caught my attention. And I'm thankful for your insight.
I'll provide some content for your show notes.
Okay, very good. All right, then. So saying that, before we just wrap up, is there anything else that you wanted to get to and bring up? I'm glad to have you on again, though.
Well, I'll gladly come on again when there is really something to talk about or things are changing. And the thing I want to end with is whatever happens in the near future, don't be alarmed and don't be paralyzed by fear. When so-called Al-Qaeda struck in New York City, then the big financial crisis, and then COVID, and now the Russians. So don't get paralyzed by fear, because it stops you from thinking and making good decisions. So the only message I would have to the audience that I can address right now, and I have the privilege to do so, is don't be paralyzed by fear. Don't let fear allow your thinking and reasoning. That's what fear does. It paralyzes your reasoning and good sense.
Very good note to end on. Joachim Van Wing, thank you so much for your time today. And I'll speak to you maybe in 2 weeks, and we can take up again your other notes that you want to talk about, you know, this angst and fear in society and the COVID aftermath. I mean, you know, just the number of doctors that are coming out to say, and all the whistleblowers that are talking about what Pfizer has been hiding, we'll leave that for another show. But thank you so much, and you've given us a lot to think about today.
Thank you for having me, Len, and looking forward to speaking to you again soon.
Okay, very good.